Hello, and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, July 22nd, 2022. I'm your reader, Steve Forrest. Here's your first story on the front page of the Sioux City Journal today. Victory, the Plymouth County Fair. Iowa State Fair Queen returning to her roots. Lamar's, Iowa. By Monday night, McKenna Hendrick had been to 33 county fairs in Iowa this summer. She had plans for 25 more. Hendrick will return to what she considers the fairest of them all next week, the Plymouth County Fair. She won't have much time before rushing off to another county, but the Akron-Westfield High School graduate looks forward to every minute she can spend at the fairgrounds in Lamar's. Plymouth County is in my roots. It's who I am. To me, Plymouth County will never be anything but the best, Hendrick said. After being named Plymouth County Fair Queen last summer, Hendrick went on to be crowned the Iowa State Fair Queen. She'll be on hand to crown her Plymouth County successor at Wednesday's King and Queen coronation, one of dozens of activities and events expected to again attract more than 100,000 visitors during the fair's five-day run Wednesday through Sunday. It's going to be pretty amazing, but I think I'm going to be pretty sad, Hendrick said of relinquishing her title. There's no sadness when Hendrick talks about the fair, however. Though she grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota, her summers included visits to her family's roots in Plymouth County, where her grandparents took her to the fair, always hitting the smoothie stand and taking in the beef show. I spent a lot of my time in the animal buildings, Hendrick said. Prior to Hendrick's eighth grade year, parents Brad and Michelle Hendrick moved to Akron to be closer to family, and the fair became a big part of McKenna's summers. She joined Akron-Westfield's FFA chapter, volunteering each summer for cleanup, setup, the pork producer stand, and other events. With her love for the fair and agriculture, Hendrick decided to run for Fair Queen, believing she could help attract the county's next generation to the fair. I had been in a lot of leadership positions and thought that what better way to get involved than to run for Fair Queen, she said. I'm a pretty outgoing person and I thought it would help me connect with younger people. Hendrick earned her FFA chapter's nomination to run for Queen, but figured her candidacy was a long shot, considering there were 28 other girls vying for the crown. She impressed the judges and the other candidates, winning Miss Congeniality in addition to Fair Queen, a title that qualified her for the state Fair Queen competition in Des Moines a month later. When walking into the first day of interviews with the other 102 candidates from across the state, Hendrick hoped she could just represent her home county well. I remember thinking this is a lot of girls and this is going to be a tough competition, Hendrick said. I did not think I was going to win in any way. She nearly lost her voice during the first 4 days of parades, modeling, and numerous interviews, but emerged as a judge's unanimous choice, an announcement that shocked her. It still blows my mind when I stop and think I won, she said. The rest of the fair was a whirlwind of early mornings and late nights, full of public appearances, pictures, food sampling, and speaking. More post-fair engagements lasted until Hendricks left for her freshman year at South Dakota State University, where she's majoring in nursing. The state fair's demand on her time slowed during the academic year, but she made it to every event the fair board asked her to attend. Her queenly duties picked up again once county fair season was started. She has judged at least 20 county fair queen competitions this summer while hitting fairs in every corner of the state in her effort to visit 58 county fairs and set a new record for most visited by the reigning state fair queen. On Tuesday, she was summoned to Des Moines for official state fair business, having the enviable task of sampling food at the fair's new food contest. As of Tuesday's interview, it had been 13 days since Hendrick had been home, but she wasn't complaining. "I definitely believe this is an opportunity of a lifetime," she said. And she can't wait for the opportunity to get back to her home county, taking in what she calls the best county fair in the state. "I will definitely say yes. In my eyes, Plymouth County is the one to see," Henrik said. Her opinion might be a little biased, but how can you argue with someone who's already seen dozens of the others? If you go, the Plymouth County Fair is July 27th to 31st. The fairgrounds are open daily from 7 a.m. to midnight. The Plymouth County Fairgrounds is in Lamars, Iowa. For ticket information and to see a schedule of the events, visit www.plymouthcountyfair.org. Okay, our next story on the front page of today's Sioux City Journal. Unity Point, Sioux City CEO Lorenzo Suter leaves. Glasgow again to step in as interim leader. Lorenzo Suter, who stepped into the role of president and CEO of Unity Point Health, Sioux City, barely a year ago, has left the organization effective immediately. The reasons for Suter's departure was not indicated in a statement Unity Point provided to the Journal on Thursday. Lee Glasgow, who had served as interim CEO of Unity Point Health, Sioux City, after the departure of previous president and CEO Lynn Wold in late 2020, will again take the reins at the organization, according to the email. Glasgow also serves as president and CEO of Unity Point Health, Fort Dodge. Lee will partner closely with Sue Erickson, Chief Operating Officer, and the Sioux City senior team to support our Sioux City region as we determine next steps regarding a search for a new permanent CEO, Unity Point said in an internal communication obtained by the Journal. "We recognize this type of change can be very challenging. However, Lee is very familiar with our Sioux City market and cares deeply about the Sioux City team and our Unity Point Health family," the message continued. Suter, a native of Lexington, Kentucky, became the head of Unity Point Health Sioux City on July 19, 2021. He had previously held a CEO position at DuPont Hospital in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Suter's career ascent from a CNA in high school to leadership roles of major hospitals was a popular narrative within Unity Point. At one time, he had wanted to be a physician. "Some people may serve different things in the industry of healthcare. My core belief is I'm serving the patient," Suter told the Journal last July. "In my role today, I will never try to attempt to make a decision outside of putting the patient first." Suter started his administration career at Southeast Alabama Medical Center, a not-for-profit hospital in Dothan, Alabama. He also served as Chief Operating Officer at Baptist Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, and Vice President of Operations at McNeil Hospital in Berwyn, Illinois. Before he arrived at Unity Point Sioux City, his most recent leadership position was at DuPont Hospital, a 131-bed, fully accredited for-profit, syndicated hospital that is part of the CHS Lutheran Health Network based in Fort Wayne. Okay, we have another story on the front page today, updated. Three Siouxland families are suing Tyson over worker's death at the Storm Lake plant. Tyson Fresh Meats contends the federal court is the proper venue in which to resolve gross negligent lawsuits filed by the estates of three workers who contracted COVID-19 at the company's Storm Lake, Iowa pork plant and later died. The Arkansas-based meat packer on Tuesday removed three lawsuits from Buena Vista County District Court to U.S. District Court in Sioux City, saying the cases belong there because at the time of the workers' deaths, Tyson was operating under the federal critical infrastructure designation at the direction and supervision of former President Donald Trump and other federal officials. That designation allowed meat plants nationwide to remain open at full production as the novel coronavirus spread throughout the country. The designation was part of a March 2020 national emergency declaration to secure the national food supply. Because defendants continued to operate Tyson's facilities at the direction of federal officers at the highest levels, a federal court must resolve this case, Tyson lawyers said in each of the notices to remove the cases to federal court. Storm Lake attorney Willis Hamilton, whose firm is representing the workers' families, said he would be filing motions to remand the case back to Buena Vista County. I don't know why Tyson is so afraid of the local district court, Hamilton said. The cases belong in the location where the workers lived and died. The families filed their lawsuits in Buena Vista County in June, saying Tyson and his plant managers knew of the risks of COVID-19 soon after the outbreak in early 2020, but continued to expose workers to higher risks of contracting the virus by forcing them to work within 6 feet of one another, without proper barriers between them or proper personal protection equipment. The suit also said Tyson employed inadequate sanitizing and disinfecting procedures, inadequate COVID-19 testing and screening, and failed to comply with state and national safety precautions while not slowing production at the plant. Suing Tyson and plant officials for gross negligence are the estates of Ken Jones, 60, a 12-year employee who died in June 3, 2020, Juan Samudio, 60, who died in June 10, 2020, and had worked for more than 5 years at Tyson, and Victor Rivera, a 27-year-old Tyson employee who died on June 15, 2020. In addition to the company, their families are suing plant manager Rick Retzlaff, safety manager Jorge Sandoval, plant superintendent Nathan Carnine, and area safety manager Lori Garcia. The families each seek judgments to compensate them for their losses and damages, which the lawsuit said exceeds $10,000 each. Tyson, which employs more than 2,300 workers at its Storm Lake pork and turkey processing plants, called the allegations willful misconduct, inaccurate, and incorrect in Tuesday's court filings. Tyson has said it is not liable for the workers' deaths and has denied claims for workers' compensation benefits filed by their families. Tyson spokeswoman Liz Croston said the company would not comment on the pending litigation. In December 2020, the family of 65-year-old Michael Eberhard, a 27-year Storm Lake Tyson worker who died from COVID-19 on June 18, 2020, sued Tyson, claiming the company forced him to work without proper safety measures. Tyson removed that case to federal court as well, and Hamilton filed a motion to remand the case to Buena Vista County. The case was stayed for several months while the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals considered whether the federal judge was correct in remanding two similar lawsuits filed in connection with COVID-19 deaths of workers at the Meatpackers Waterloo, Iowa plant from federal court to a state court. The Eighth Circuit Court in June affirmed the judge's decision, and Hamilton has renewed his motion to remand the Eberhard lawsuit to state court, while Tyson has indicated it will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the Eighth Circuit ruling. Nearly a year ago, Tyson touted its coronavirus response, announcing it would require all its workers to be vaccinated against the virus. At that time, the company has said it spent more than $700 million related to COVID-19, including purchase of masks, face shields, and temperature scanners, installation of protective barriers, and providing on-site testing and vaccinations. The company has also partnered with an independent medical provider to bring medical services on-site and hired an additional 200 nurses and its first chief medical officer. Okay, we're moving on to page 2 of the Sioux City Journal today. We'll read the briefs from Sibley, Iowa. Sibley man pleads not guilty of sex abuse. A Sibley man has pleaded not guilty of sexually abusing a child over a 3-year period, Mitchell Duskin entered his written plea Wednesday in Osceola County District Court to 5 counts of second-degree sexual abuse. According to court documents, Duskin had sexual contact with the child, who was under age 14, from November 2018 through November 2020. A man is sentenced in Sioux City for COVID fraud. A Virginia man who conspired with a former Iowa resident to launder illegally obtained COVID-19 relief funds must repay more than $1.2 million and spend more than 3 years in federal prison. Benjamin Sackey, 31, of Dumfries, Virginia, was sentenced Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to 40 months in prison in order to pay restitution of $1.03 million to Cross River Bank and $183,000 to the Small Business Administration. He pleaded guilty in February to money laundering conspiracy. Sackley fraudulently obtained more than $900,000 in CARES Act funds at 3 banks in the names of 2 Virginia corporations, then transferred the money elsewhere. He had received the money from Donald Trosen, a Minnesota man formerly from Armstrong, Iowa, who had submitted more than 20 fraudulent COVID financial assistance loan applications to the Small Business Administration. Trosen said he had 120 employees and more than $5 million in payroll, but did not operate any businesses. Trosen was sentenced in July 2021 to 40 months in prison after pleading guilty to fraud and money laundering. He and Sackey were ordered to pay the restitution jointly. Next story, long lines gets okay for early voting. Long Lines Recreation Center has been an early voting location in Sioux City for 10 years. This year, the League of Women Voters submitted a petition to keep it operating following changes to election laws. Changes made in 2021 required a petition of 100 voter signatures for a county to hold a satellite voting location. In the past, the county auditor could choose. Dagma Simmons, president of the League of Women Voters, Sioux City, submitted 276 signatures to the auditor's office on Wednesday. She said the league has been collecting signatures at various events. She said they wanted to make sure it was operational because many people throughout Sioux City use it. "We want to encourage voting by every eligible citizen, and we want to protect voting rights," she said. One way to do that is to ensure that Long Lines Recreation Center voting location is available leading up to Election Day. "There's a lot of reasons why people cannot vote at their precinct on voting, and there's also reasons why they can't deal with an absentee ballot through the mail," she said. The Long Lines early voting site gets several thousand voters for major elections, said Auditor Pat Gill. "The citizens will have to petition every election for satellite voting locations anywhere in the county," Gill said. Wednesday, Iowa Technical Community College is also gathering signatures for a satellite location. This particular change is one of the many approved in the 2021 that Simmons said restricts voter access to elections. The time to receive absentee ballots has been reduced from 120 days ahead of the election to 70. Absentee ballots must also be received by the office before the end of Election Day, whereas previously it had only been postmarked on Election Day. Gill said he appreciates the League of Women Voters for petitioning the petition together. October 19th is the first day of early voting, with the general election on November 8th. The Long Lines Recreation Center location will be open with potential weekend times as well. Iowa making a drought plan as climate risks rise. A warmer atmosphere means it takes longer to rain. This is from Cedar Rapids. As nights stay hotter and precipitation is less consistent, Iowa's at risk for more frequent droughts. That's why state officials want to develop a plan that would include a trigger point to call for precautions, such as water rationing. The benefit of a trigger is it gives you something to point to, said Tim Hall, chief of the Iowa Geological and Water Survey Bureau at the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. About 20 emergency management officials, water treatment employees, and others gathered Thursday at Kirkwood Community College in Cedar Rapids to talk about the need for drought plan and what it should get into. This is one of five stakeholder meetings across the county. The nonprofit Climate Center group of scientists and community educators reported Iowa, Montana, and Oklahoma have the worst drought vulnerability among all 50 states based on exposure and climate and sensitivity to drought, as well as their ability to adapt to it. We don't irrigate across the state of Iowa or have the ability to irrigate, Glisson said of Iowa's agricultural crops, primarily corn and soybeans. Our crops need water. Corn needs 25 inches of water per year to grow. Glisson and other state officials hope that by creating a drought plan, Iowa can reduce its vulnerability. The long-term climate trends are concerning, Glisson said. Iowa's daily temperature has increased about 1.3 degrees since 1895. That doesn't sound like a lot, but the bulk of that change is happening at night, when clouds cover traps the heat from the day close to the earth. Not cooling off at night exacerbates drought conditions, Glisson said. A warmer atmosphere holds more water vapor, about 4% more in Iowa, and doesn't let it go as rain until it reaches critical mass. This means some of Iowa is more likely to get 3 to 4 inches of rain in a few hours, leaving parts of the state very wet, while others are still experiencing a drought, Glisson said. Much of Iowa faced drought last summer, despite a wet October when an average 5 inches of rain fell across the state. Much of Iowa is still dry. The U.S. Drought Monitor's most recent Iowa map, published online Thursday, shows extreme drought extending into a third northwest Iowa county, as compared with the previous week, and southeast Iowa developing a pocket of moderate drought. Participants at Thursday's meeting said the drought plan should factor in rainfall. Both here and in the watershed further north, temperature and soil moisture. They said having a state plan that defines drought will make it easier to improve water restrictions if necessary. Hall said one idea is to create a drought website, similar to the Iowa Flood Information System, that could gather data on drought risks and model how that would affect different parts of the state. The Iowa DNR, Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship plan to create by October a draft plan will be available for public comment. They hope to have the final plan by the end of the year. Okay, we're still on page 2 of the Sioux City Journal. The FBI says no sign of Hoffa under bridge. In Detroit, the FBI found no evidence of missing Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa during a search of land under the New Jersey Bridge, a spokesman said Thursday. The Pulaski Skyway now becomes another dead end in the decades-long mystery that stretched from a Michigan horse farm to the East Coast. Where are the remains of one of America's most powerful labor leaders? The 47-year-old Riddle turned last year to land next to a former landfill under a bridge in Jersey City. The FBI conducted a search there in early June. Nothing of evidentiary value was discovered during that search, said Mara Schneider, an FBI spokeswoman in Detroit. While we do not currently anticipate any additional activity at the site, the FBI will continue to pursue any viable leads in our efforts to locate Mr. Hoffa, she said. Schneider declined to comment further when asked for details about the excavation. Authorities believe Hoffa disappeared in suburban Detroit in 1975 while meeting with reputed mobsters. Dan Moldea, a journalist who has written extensively about the Hoffa saga, said he was personally briefed by the FBI in a video conference call Thursday. He said the FBI and his contractors did not dig in the exact spot that he recommended. I'm not thrilled with the result. My impression today was them breaking the bad news to me. Thanks for the tip, but it's over. That's my interpretation, Maldea said. Maldea said the FBI told him it did not dig in the exact spot that he recommended because radar showed nothing suspicious below ground. I do think they missed this one spot, he said. I think the body's there. We just can't find it. The FBI reached out to Maldea last year after he published a detailed account from Frank Capola, who was a teenager in the 1970s when he worked at the old PJP landfill near the bridge. Capola and his father Paul Capola, who had worked at the landfill, explained how Hoffa's body was delivered there in 1975, placed in a steel drum and buried with other barrels, bricks, and dirt. Paul Capola, worried that police might be watching, dug a hole on a New Jersey state property about 100 yards from the landfill and subsequently moved the unmarked barrel there, according to Maldea. Frank Capola spoke to Fox Nation and Medulla before he died in 2020 and signed a document attesting to his late father's story. Hoffa was president of the 2.1 million Teamster Union from 1957 to 71, even keeping the title while in prison for trying to bribe jurors during a previous trial. He was released in prison in 1971 when President Nixon shortened his sentence. It has long been speculated that Hoffa, who was 62, was killed by enemies because he was planning a Teamster comeback. He was declared legally dead in 1982. Okay, today we have a story on the COVID. Behind the BA.5, the variant is dominating U.S. cases. The BA.5 subvariant of the coronavirus has rapidly become dominant in the United States, and rising COVID-19 case numbers are dashing hopes for summer break from the pandemic. The Biden administration responded July 12th by once again urging people to get booster shots. But those vaccines are unchanged since the rollout more than a year and a half ago. In June, an advisory committee for the Food and Drug Administration reviewed data for updated vaccines, but even those newer versions are based on the original Omicron variant, not the BA.5 version now on the rise. As the pandemic drabs on, it's fair to wonder if we're ever going to catch up. The good news is that BA.5 is not some sort of supervirus, contrary to what it might sound like in more alarmist corners of social media. And while this latest version of the virus has mutated substantially since the beginning of the pandemic, it's still the coronavirus. The original vaccines remain remarkably effective at preventing serious disease and death, even from the BA.5. Scientists predict that someday they will develop a pan-coronavirus vaccine, one that would protect people against all variants of the coronavirus that causes COVID along with other related viruses. In one recent study, University of Pittsburgh researchers and others discovered that clues to how that might be achieved by focusing on internal proteins that all such viruses have in common. In the meantime, here's the latest on BA.5 and how to reduce the risk by taking responsible precautions. What are the symptoms of BA.5? So far, the symptoms of infection with the BA.5 seem to be much the same as COVID all along. Medical director for the infection prevention of Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia, Eric Satchiwala, said, "That means cough, fever, achy joints, and headaches. If you have those symptoms, get tested and stay clear of others, just as physicians have been recommending from the start." One encouraging difference from the earlier waves of COVID, those who get infected these days may be less likely to lose their sense of smell. Still unclear, Senchin Wallace said, is whether BA.5 is as likely to result in long COVID, the brain fog, exhaustion, and other symptoms that can linger for months. Is BA.5 more transmissible? With each new rapidly spreading variant, we hear estimates about how much more transmissible it is. If you add up all those increases in transmissibility, it might seem that COVID now spreads as easily as measles, one of the most contagious viruses known to science. It's not quite that simple, said Stephen Goldstein, an evolutionary virologist at the University of Utah. Yes, BA5 is spreading rapidly, but that in itself does not mean the subvariant is inherently more transmissible than those that came before, he said. All we know for sure is that it has a growth advantage, some combination of mutations that for now allows it to outcompete earlier versions of the virus in causing infections. BA5 may also be on the rise due to some combination of opportune timing and the behavior of the humans it infects, said Goldstein, who did his PhD on coronaviruses at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. It has been months since most people have had a dose of a vaccine, and their immunity has waned. BA5 may simply have come along at the right time to make more people sick. Why the vaccines still work? Hospitalizations have crept upward since the advent of the BA5, but they are nowhere near their peak during the winter surge with the original Omicron. At Einstein's facility in North Philadelphia, for example, a dozen patients have COVID-19, down from a high of 200 in January. And generally, hospitalized patients are much less likely to need a ventilator, he said. The people who are doing poorly are those who have other medical conditions and are still unvaccinated. Vaccinated people can become infected but remain at a low risk of severe disease. Here's why. It has been months since your last booster. You won't have high levels of antibodies circulating in the bloodstream, standing at the ready to ward off the virus, the result, infection. But once a person is infected, the invading viruses prompt the immune system to make more antibodies in a hurry, along with other defenses called T cells. While that process takes a couple of days, the vast majority of people don't become severely ill. Still, the illness is unpleasant, and it remains prudent to take other precautions, both for personal protection and limited spread to others who are more vulnerable. While most places no longer mandate a mask, it's still recommended the face covering be in crowded indoor spaces. What boosters should I get? For now, the FDA has authorized a second booster shot for those over 50 years old, along with people who are immunocompromised. Those vaccines based on the original coronavirus. The vaccine makers have since tested vaccines based on the BA1 version of Omicron, and they are now developing vaccines that are tailored to defend against the newer BA4 and BA5 subvariants. The FDA has recommended that drug makers produce a bivalent vaccine for rollout late this year, with genetic material from both the original coronavirus and the latest versions of Omicron. For those who have yet to get a booster, should you wait until then? No, said White House COVID response coordinator Ashish Jha, who spoke at the briefing Tuesday. People will be allowed to get both. If you get vaccinated today, you are not going to be ineligible to get the variant-specific vaccine as we get into the later part of fall and winter, he said. So it's not a trade-off. You're listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Steve Forrest. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Richard Huertas. Richard M. Huertas, 69, of South Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, July 19, 2022. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Monday at First Lutheran Church in Sioux City. Visitation with the family present will be from 6 to 7 p.m., with a prayer service at 7 p.m. on Sunday evening at Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home. Online condolences may be directed to www.meyerbroschapel.com. Rick was born October 29, 1952, in Lamars, Iowa, to Stanley and Frances Huertas. He grew up in rural Lamars and graduated from Lamar Community High School in 1971. He remained in the Siouxland area his entire life, spending time near Brunswick, Iowa, and Lamars before making his home in South Sioux City. He began working alongside his parents at their trucking company, which led Rick to a life spent in the trucking industry. The early part of his career was spent driving over the road until an accident caused him to switch paths. He then found his way forward by dispatching for BT Incorporated. Most recently, he was a transportation and logistics manager of Power Only Transport, a division of Keter Trailer Sales. When he wasn't working, Rick loved being outdoors. He enjoyed fishing, hunting, and showing horses. Rick was known for his giving spirit and friendly nature. He was a very involved and dedicated member of the First Lutheran Church in Sioux City, of the NIHSA, American Quarter Horse Association, and numerous saddle clubs over the years. He was a proud owner of Huertas Quarter Horses. He enjoyed following NASCAR and the Nebraska Cornhuskers. Rick loved spending time with his grandchildren and bragging about them to anyone that would listen. He's survived by his four children, Brian Rollins of South Sioux City, Travis Huertas, Julianne of Blount, South Dakota, Trent Huertas, Tiffany of Elk Point, South Dakota, Toby Pickett, John of Sioux City, six grandchildren, two brothers, Daniel Huertas of Pigeon and Thomas Huertas of Marlene of Lamars, two sisters, Carol Califex of Alexandria, Minnesota, and Gail Wilbur of Lorton, Virginia. Numerous nieces and nephews, and all those fortunate enough to call him a friend. He was preceded in death by his wife Kathy, parents Bub and Babe, and grandson Brendan Huertas. Russell Rusty Gill of Sioux City, 70, died Tuesday, July 19, 2022. No services held at this time. Arrangements with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Arthur Dean Albrecht of Sioux City. Arthur Dean Albrecht, 84, of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, July 19, 2022, surrounded by family. Services will be 10:30 a.m. on Monday at Holy Cross Parish, Blessed Sacrament. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday, July 24, 2022, with a vigil service at 6 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Dean was born the son of Arthur F. and Wilma Albrecht on July 20, 1938, in Hartington, Nebraska. He graduated from Hartington High School and then honorably served in the United States Army. On April 30, 1960, he married Mary Becker in Harrington. They made their home in Sioux City, and together they raised four children, Mark, Sherry, Joe, and Julie. They enjoyed 56 years together until Mary passed away in 2017. Dean was a union painter for Meyer Painting for 40 years until his retirement. Dean enjoyed fishing, camping, and spending time with his family. He was a longtime member of Holy Cross Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. He is survived by his children, Mark Albrecht of Olathe, Kansas, Sherry Jones of Des Moines, Joe Albrecht of Sergeant Bluff, and Julie Sukup of Chicago, Illinois. 11 grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife Mary, brother Kenneth, and sister Elaine. Alexander Estevez, 54, of South Sioux City, formerly of Worcester, Massachusetts, died on July 20th, 2022. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel in Sioux City. Alexander was born in Worcester, and following his graduation from North High School in Worcester, he went into the United States Marine Corps. He served in Okinawa, Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. Following his service in the Marine Corps, Alexander worked as an iron worker full-time, helping to build the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, while he earned his degree in economics from Boston University, where he graduated in 1988. He wanted to become a defense attorney after watching Perry Mason, and earned his law degree from New England School of Law in 1991. Alexander was a talented writer and had three articles published in legal journals. He worked as a defense attorney in Boston and Sioux City. Alexander had a big personality that filled the room and a tremendous sense of humor. Alexander enjoyed writing poetry and being creative in the kitchen. He is survived by his son Nicholas and wife Jill. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to the Food Bank of Siouxland Backpack Program. Another obituary today, Robert D. Ellis, formerly Sioux City and Dakota Dunes. Robert Bob Ellis, 87, formerly of Sioux City and Dakota Dunes, passed away Saturday, July 16, 2022, in Papillion, Nebraska, due to complications from long-haul COVID. Bob was surrounded by his loved ones at the time of his passing. Joint celebration of life for Bob and his late wife, Sandy, will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, August 26th at the Sioux City Arts Center, 225 Nebraska Street, with a short memorial program at 4:30. Bob was born on June 30, 1935 in Sioux City to Sylvan and Inez Ellis. He started grade school at Bryan Elementary before his family moved to Carroll, Iowa, where he attended junior high school and high school. He graduated from Carroll High School in 1953. Following high school, Bob attended the University of South Dakota, where he joined Phi Delta Theta fraternity, earned his business degree, and was a member of the Army ROTC. Bob proudly served his country in the Army Reserve for many years and was honorably discharged with the rank of captain in 1966. While at USD, Rob met the love of his life, Sandy Sona, a fraternity sorority mixer during their freshman year. Bob and Sandy were married on June 1, 1957 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Following the wedding, the couple moved to Sioux City, where they lived happily and virtually inseparably for the next 64 years. The couple had two children, son Robert G. and daughter Elizabeth. Bob was a man with many talents and interests, but more than anything, he was a car man. Bob started in the automobile business from almost the day he was born, hanging out and washing vehicles in his father's used car lots in Sioux City and Carroll while in elementary school and working there through high school. He began working at Miller Kidder Chevrolet while still in college, embarking upon a career that single dealership that lasted for an incredible 45 years. Bob rose to the ranks from salesman to used and new car manager to general manager at the Knopfler dealership, and he truly loved his co-workers, employees, customers, and all those he interacted with during his decades in the car business. He won numerous sales awards and recognitions from General Motors and Chevrolet over the years, including several overseas trips, which he and Sandy enjoyed greatly and recounted fondly for the rest of their lives. Following his retirement from the car business, Bob embarked upon a new venture where he owned and operated two Kizno sub-stores in Sioux City with his daughter, Beth. He loved being in the restaurant business and enjoyed the daily interactions with the store's employees, vendors, and especially its customers and their families. Once that venture ended, Bob returned to his roots and spent his senior years driving cars for several local dealerships for trade and sale to other automotive businesses over the Midwest. Bob is survived by his children, Bob Ellis, with Laura and Beth Ellis, Mark, granddaughter Carolyn Kohlers, and Madison Ellis, sister-in-law Jane Hayden, brother-in-law Larry Kennedy, and many nieces, nephews, and countless friends who remain to honor his memory. He was preceded in death by his beloved wife, Sandy, parents-in-laws Gary and Eleanor, Sona, sister Patricia Kennedy, and brother-in-law Dr. Buzz Hayden. The family requested any memorials which friends may wish to make in Bob's honor be directed to the Boys and Girls Club of Siouxland. Okay, here's a local story from Sioux City. Municipal band performance to feature a xylophone. The Sioux City Municipal Band's final concert of the summer, taking place at 7:30 p.m. Sunday at Grandview Park's Bandshell, will feature Ron Smith playing George Hamilton Green's high-energy Fluffy Ruffles on xylophone. Led by conductor Michael Pritchard, the concert will feature a medley from the movie My Fair Lady, plus Carl King's Homestretch Gallop and John Philip Sousa Freelance March. The traditional audience sing-along, led by host Dave Madsen of Morningside University, will include Hello Dolly and Good Night Ladies. The free concert series are presented by the Sioux City Parks and Recreation Department. Here we have some local church news. There's a pancake breakfast. St. John Lutheran Church, 2801 Jackson Street, will host a pancake breakfast from 7 to 11 a.m. July 23rd. A free will offering. There will also be a $2 raffle tickets for the opportunity to either a crib quilt, a festive holiday topper, or a wood carving of Jesus. Proceeds go to benefit our food pantry mission. There's also a Greek fest. Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church at the corner of 6th and Jennings will host its Greek Fest from Friday, July 29th to Sunday, July 31st. Hours will be from 6 to 10 p.m. on Friday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Saturday, and 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. Come for authentic Greek food and pastries, Greek music and folk dancing, taverna, bar, bake sale, and market, Grecian boutique and church tours, curbside drive-thru available. Blessing of the Bikes will be at 6 p.m. on Saturday. All are welcome. Heart of Barbecue. ELCA Lutheran Churches in Western Iowa are hosting the second annual Heart of Barbecue event on Saturday, July 30th at the Four County Fairgrounds in Dunlop, Iowa. All are invited. Barbecue teams from area churches will provide great food. Activities begin at 3 p.m. with dinner serving at 5:30. More information available from the ELCA Western Iowa Synod at 712-732-4968. And there's an ice cream social, the Ladies Aid Group of Hope Lutheran Church, 218 West 18th Street in South Sioux City, will have its annual ice cream social from 4 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, August 4th. The menu includes tavern, chips, pie, and ice cream, plus beverage, all for $7. Each item may also be bought individually. Okay, we'll now do a story from the opinion section. South Dakota budget surplus and the realities. South Dakota finished the most recent fiscal year with a $150 million budget surplus, which has given lawmakers reason to celebrate and self-congratulate. In fact, Governor Kristi Noem said in a press release announcing the surplus Monday that South Dakota has the strongest economy in the nation. So, why doesn't it feel that way? Even though the state has racked up surpluses since 2012, there always seems to be the storyline that finances are tight, and Pierre doesn't have the money to do a number of things that some people implore it to do. For his instance, our state teachers' salaries remain problematic. This issue received a modest boost in 2016 with a voter-approved tax that helped lift South Dakota out of last place nationally in educator pay for the first time since 1985. However, the salaries gradually set it back to the bottom of the rankings. A 6% boost in teacher pay approved this past winter lifted the state's salaries from 51st in the nation to 48, according to the Associated School Board of South Dakota. But history suggests it's only a fleeting rise, and that without follow-up action, we shall soon revert back to our norm. Also, we still trail our neighboring states, which means South Dakota is at a perpetual competitive disadvantage when it comes to hiring and maintaining teachers. South Dakota is one of 12 states that has not expanded Medicaid, which would help more than 42,000 low-income people get insurance coverage. The question has never made it out of the state capitol, so now it's being taken to the voters so that they may decide the matter. South Dakota still taxes food and groceries. An effort to raise the 4.5% tax off food made it out of the South Dakota House this winter, but was killed in the Senate. A repeal would give a boost to lower-income families who are hit the hardest by the regressive tax. This state is also, according to a pair of surveys in recent years, the national leader in states where people work at least two jobs. As recently as 2017, it was reported that 9.5% of South Dakotans hold two jobs, which was twice the national average. Also, South Dakota is home to six of the 50 counties and or parishes in the U.S. with the lowest per capita personal income, and the state remains among the nation's leaders in infant mortality rate. And yet, we congratulate ourselves on this $150 million surplus. That influx raises the state's budget reserve to $442.6 million, which is equal to 20.5% of the 2023 fiscal year general fund budget. But next winter, we're sure to hear again about tight budgeting and uncertain economic outlook, making it difficult to invest in ideas such as raising aid for public schools, funding statewide pre-kindergarten, bolstering long-term care facilities, and more. This isn't to say the state should go on a spending frenzy and drain its reserves. That would be reckless. But nothing in this situation is particularly new. As mentioned above, South Dakota has been running budget surpluses for a decade, and the educational, social, and health issues have been around for years and years. So, as we pat ourselves on the back for our budget surpluses, which have been fueled recently by federal COVID-19 relief funding and our financial acumen, we need to also bear in mind that prosperity is about more than what's on the balance sheet. It's also about how much good it can do for the people. Otherwise, celebrating surpluses feels disconnected with the realities on the ground. Okay, here's a few brief stories. Polio. An unvaccinated young adult from New York recently contracted polio, the first U.S. case in nearly a decade, health officials said Thursday. Officials said the patient developed paralysis. The person developed symptoms a month ago and is no longer deemed contagious. Contraception. The right to use contraceptives would be enshrined in law under a measure that Democrats pushed through the House on Thursday. The House's 228-195 roll call was largely along party lines and sent the measure to the Senate, where it seemed doomed. The heat wave. Dangerously high temperatures threatened much of the Northeast and Deep South on Thursday as huge swaths of the country sweltered under the heat wave that could continue for days and sent temperatures soaring in places like Boston, Little Rock, and Virginia Beach. Endangered. The monarch butterfly fluttered a step closer to extinction Thursday as scientists put the iconic orange and black insect on the endangered list because of its fast dwindling numbers. Unemployment. Applications for jobless aid for the week ending July 16th rose by 7,000 to 251,000, up from the previous week's 244,000, the Labor Department reported Thursday. That's the most since 265,000 on November 13th, 2021. In Chicago, a federal lawsuit filed Thursday alleges Chicago police misused unreliable gunshot detection technology and failed to pursue other leads in investigating a grandfather from the city's south side and charging him with killing a neighbor. Michael Williams spent nearly a year in jail before a judge dismissed his case at the request of prosecutors, who said they had insufficient evidence. Okay. Today on the opinion section is a Bible verse. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Steve Forrest. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.